Well, good morning, everybody, and welcome to Bio241. You had a test last time. Got those graded. Your grades are in Blackboard. Some people have stopped by to look at their exams. And of course, I always recommend that students come take a look at their exams and just correlate with what they think they put on the Scantron and what they actually did. Okay, and look back at the questions. Now, you've seen a lot of those questions already at the end of the chapter and online questions. Maybe some I made up myself. So another good reason to come and check out the exam is just make sure you're reading the questions correctly. Right? But there were some really good tests. Congratulations to those people that did really well on the exam. Here is the sign-in sheet for today, and today is March 20th. Here's the sign-in sheets. Go ahead and pass that around. And if you haven't seen your score in Blackboard, a couple of students stopped by and we were able to find your exam. It was usually in the wrong pile, and or you didn't show me an ID or something like that, and we can get that straightened out and put your grade into Blackboard right away. All right, so today, like I said, is the 20th, so we're going to look at autonomic nervous system. You guys know a lot about the autonomic nervous system already in terms of its anatomy, but if you've forgotten, we can't go over it today. You got to pick it up on your own. I'll review some stuff, but not just a whole lot. And we might get into some sensory physiology later today, but probably not. All right, so we got two lectures this week, two lectures next week, and then we got spring break the week after that. And then the week right after spring break, guess what we have? Another exam, exam number three, but it's not on a Tuesday this time. It's on a Thursday. Oh, I guess the last test we had was on a Thursday too. All right, so the first one we had on a Tuesday, then we had one on Thursday, and my guess is that our fourth exam is going to be back on a Tuesday again. So that kind of evens out, right, the crunch for those of you that have lab on Tuesdays or Thursdays. And then here's your final exam, May 24th. You don't have labs that week, so that doesn't conflict with anybody's lab schedule. All right, so is everybody aware of what the schedule is? So how do you do well in this class? What's like the most fundamental thing? Study a little bit every day, okay? And I saw some students actually working on the figures for today's lecture. That is really handy if you have in your mind kind of a framework of the pictures that I'm going to show or figures I'm going to show in today's lecture. That will really help you out a lot. All right, so autonomic nervous system. No questions on the schedule, right? So let's just show these PowerPoints on both screens. We're going to talk about most of this stuff in today's lecture. There we go. All right, so autonomic nervous system manages our physiology for us. In what kind of way? A conscious way or an unconscious way? Okay, unconscious. A voluntary way or involuntary way? Involuntary, right? So it's unconscious. Controlled. All right, by regulating organs and organ systems. And you should then have in your mind the three kinds of effectors that are controlled by the autonomic nervous system. So think of a response loop. What does an effector always produce? A response. Yeah, so it's some kind of organ in your body that can produce a response. And for the autonomic nervous system, what are the organs, the general classes of organs that can produce a response? Smooth muscle, cardiac muscle. And glands, that's right. And then there's one other kind of effector in your body that's not controlled by autonomic nervous system. And what is that? And that's skeletal muscle. That's controlled by the somatic, right, motor nervous system. You have conscious control of that. And as a matter of fact, if everything, all the organs in your body, all the effectors in your body, the only thing that you have voluntary control of are skeletal muscles. Everything else is controlled autonomically. So this is a pretty important chapter that we're going to look at. So this slide is deficient in something. What is this slide deficient in? We got smooth muscle and glands right here, but what would you want to add to this slide? Cardiac muscle as well, yeah. Okay, and smooth muscle, and as a matter of fact, even the heart can relate to this slide right here. Smooth muscle maintains a resting tone in the absence of innervation. Smooth muscle does not necessarily need innervation to contract or to maintain a baseline level of contraction. And it just so happens that when smooth muscle is denervated due to injury, for instance, right, it becomes hypersensitive. So when the autonomic nervous system input is taken away from smooth muscle, it becomes more sensitive and usually causes hyperexcitability or hypersensitivity, which leads to contraction. Many types of smooth muscle, just like your heart, are spontaneously active. They will go through rhythmic changes of contraction and relaxation, right? And I'm sure you're aware your heart does that as well. And the autonomic nervous system input to these kinds of smooth muscles and the heart just changes the intrinsic rhythmicity of the heart, right? So it can increase the rate of contraction or decrease the rate of contraction, but innervation is not absolutely necessary. These muscles will contract on their own, just like Raiders of the Lost Ark. When that person had his heart ripped out of the side of his chest and placed on the table, it did what? It just beated. Well, maybe it was before your time. I'm not sure. Okay. The heart will beat outside of an animal's chest. Okay, let's compare a somatic motor pathway versus an autonomic motor pathway. This top figure right here, I see it going to skeletal muscle. So this is a somatic motor pathway. And you can see that the efferent nerve leaves which root in the spinal cord? The ventral root. So the ventral root is efferent or motor. And here's the cell body and gray matter of the spinal cord. And then this long axon goes all the way to an effector organ. Right? So here is the ventral root, and then that becomes a spinal nerve. And that spinal nerve carries this nerve fiber to the effector organ. So that's just a very, very long cell. And how many cells does it take to get from CNS to this effector organ? How many cells do you see right there? Just one. Here's one cell body. Then here's the axon terminus of that same cell. So it's just a single neuron. We're not going to pay particular attention to this afferent pathway right here. But again, it takes just one neuron to go from a receptor, right, in through the dorsal root into the central nervous system for a somatic pathway. Right, but I'm really interested in this motor pathway, not so much the sensory pathway. And we're going to compare and contrast this pathway to the autonomic motor pathway. Right, the cell bodies are in the lateral horn of the spinal cord gray matter, and then the axon leads again through the ventral root. Right, and then we see it gets into the spinal nerve, and then it enters something that we call the sympathetic chain ganglia. And within the sympathetic chain, right, we have these ganglia right here. What the heck is a ganglia? I see one up over here as well. But what the heck is a ganglion? It's a collection of cell bodies, and the cell bodies here are, what, these are unipolar neurons. So all the cell bodies are right here. These are multipolar neurons, right? Any kind of motor neuron is a multipolar neuron. And here I can see a cell body of another neuron, and that's probably nicely color-coded. Well, maybe they're the same color, but this looks like light blue, this looks like dark blue to me, all right, pretty much. So we see that, how many neurons does it take to get from the CNS to an effector organ? In this particular case, smooth muscle. It takes two, all right, so here's the presynaptic neuron, here's the synapse within the sympathetic chain ganglion, then here's the postsynaptic neuron going the rest of the way to this particular effector organ. But since it's the autonomic nervous system, right, we change the terminology a little bit. We don't really call this the presynaptic neuron because there's a ganglia right here that separates these two cells. We now call this the preganglionic neuron, and this is the postganglionic neuron. All right, and so there's a nice chemical synapse right in the sympathetic chain right here. There's some other differences in the autonomic nervous system. This preganglionic fiber is myelinated and the postganglionic fiber is not myelinated. That's another way that you should realize the autonomic outflow pathway. All right, so whether it's parasympathetic or sympathetic, it's going to require two neurons to get to an effector organ with one exception to that rule, which we're going to talk about a little bit later. Okay, so the postganglionic neuron just proceeds from the ganglion all the way to the effector organ. All right, divisions of the autonomic nervous system. Fortunately, there are only two. All right, there's sympathetic and parasympathetic, and we're going to learn a lot about the differences between these different autonomic nervous systems. These two different nervous systems are usually antagonistic to each other. That means they work in opposition. But what's the beauty of having an antagonistic system? Yeah, you can maintain precise control and balance over an effector organ. All right, and so that's the most important thing. Just like on your car. You would never think of driving your car without a brake pedal, with only a gas pedal, right? So you need these two mechanisms. All right, so sympathetic could be best described as the fight and flight nervous system. And the parasympathetic could best be described as the rest and digest, or rest and repose. Repose just means like lay down, take a nap, siesta after lunch or something, okay, when you're very inactive. So these are pretty good ways to think generally of these two different kinds of nervous systems. All right, the other thing, since we said they're antagonistic, if the sympathetic is excitatory on an organ, what is the parasympathetic nervous system going to be? Inhibitory, right? So that's a pretty good rule of thumb. Now, the sympathetic system is not always excitatory. Sometimes it is inhibitory. It flips back and forth, right? And you can memorize how it goes if you wanted to. But nonetheless, the thing that you can count on most of the time is that these two are going to be antagonistic. So if you have an organ where the sympathetic nervous system is inhibitory, what is the parasympathetic nervous system going to be? Excitatory. All right, so let's just think of a couple examples. If you have an organ like the heart where the sympathetic nervous system is excitatory, then the parasympathetic activity on the heart is going to be inhibitory. But now let's take another organ system like the digestive tract. The sympathetic nervous system is inhibitory of the digestive tract. What is the parasympathetic? It will be excitatory, right? So therefore we say digestion is stimulated by the parasympathetics and it's inhibited by the sympathetic nervous system. So these are good ways to think about just the general activities of these two nervous systems. Let's talk about the sympathetic division first. This is just a little review from anatomy. Sympathetic is also called thoracolumbar division, okay, because the preganglionics, these are the preganglionic nerve fibers, it's that first nerve fiber in a series of nerves, exit the spinal cord through spinal nerves T1 through L2. All right, and then most synapses on ganglions, right, on either side of the vertebral column that we see in this figure right here. All right, so sometimes we call these the paravertebral, meaning on either side of the vertebral column, ganglia, or sometimes we just call these the sympathetic chain ganglia. They go by either name. And these sympathetic chains right here are like very similar to same kind of function as the spinal cord. These are just auxiliary spinal cords for certain kind of activity. And what kind of activity do we find in these sympathetic chain ganglia right here, or the sympathetic chains, or the paravertebral ganglia right here? What kind of activity? It's going to be 100% sympathetic activity, which does what? It's part of the fight and flight response produced in your body. All right, so these are like auxiliary spinal cords for the fight and flight response. Okay, so it's characterized, the sympathetic division is characterized by what we call divergence and convergence. That means that these nerve fibers that leave the spinal cord will bifurcate, they will split apart, go to different parts of the body, right, and can activate, even one neuron can activate many parts of the body at one time. And it's also characterized by convergence, where many axons will converge on the postganglionic cell, okay, and that postganglionic cell then can integrate information up from various levels within the spinal cord, and we call this mass activation. So when the sympathetic nervous system becomes stimulated, okay, it can't in just one little piece of the sympathetic nervous system. The whole sympathetic autonomic nervous system becomes activated at one particular time. So we call that mass activation. And this slide right here just shows, maybe we'll go over some of these structures from anatomy, shows divergence pretty nicely. So here's the cell body of a sympathetic motor neuron. It's going to be in the lateral horn, the gray matter of the spinal cord. And this motor neuron is going to leave the ventral root, right, get into the spinal nerve, but it's not going to go directly to an effector organ because it has to enter, and every sympathetic neuron has to enter the sympathetic chain right here, and it does via, okay, and it's in the wrong location in your book. It should be actually the second one right over here, the white ramus communicantes. So hopefully that's kind of ringing a bell. The white ramus communicantes is white because why? Because it's myelinated, right? So it's a nice myelinated fiber. And so let's just pretend that this ramus is really over here, but the preganglionic fiber enters the chain, and once it's in the sympathetic chain, guess what it can do? It can pass straight through, or it can synapse, right? So here's the cell body of the postganglionic fiber, and the postganglionic fiber is shown in a dashed line, which also kind of signifies what? That it is non-myelinated. It's a non-myelinated fiber. All right, so these are two possibilities. So it can pass straight through, it can synapse, or it can arise through the sympathetic chain, a division or two, or it can descend through the sympathetic chain, a division or two or three or four, to help innervate other organs. So here is that bifurcation, and then it bifurcates once again. So that splitting of this signal, we call that what? Divergence. So this one action potential can end up in various places of the body. So all of these regions become activated when this single neuron becomes activated or stimulated. Okay, here is the second feature. Sometimes, like we said right here, the preganglionic fiber just passes straight through the sympathetic chain, but how many neurons does it take to get from the central nervous system to an effector organ? It's always going to be two. So if it doesn't synapse in the sympathetic chain or the paravertebral ganglia, it has to synapse in another ganglia someplace else. And these ganglia right here are what we call collateral ganglia or prevertebral. Prevertebral means anterior to the vertebral column. All right, so, and then here is the postganglionic fiber going the rest of the way to this effector organ. All right, so no matter what, if it synapses in the sympathetic chain or if it synapses in a collateral ganglia, it still requires two neurons to get to an effector organ. And a nerve, the name of a nerve that connects the sympathetic chain to a collateral ganglia or prevertebral ganglia that I see right here is always going to be called a splanchnic nerve. And there are different divisions of splanchnic nerves depending on if you're in the superior thorax or inferior thorax. Okay, there are different splanchnic nerves, but they're all just splanchnic nerves. So if I look at this nerve fiber right here, and it's no longer blue, it's what, red? Okay, this red axon right here, where is this red axon coming from, the preganglionic or postganglionic neuron? It's the preganglionic neuron, because you can just trace it all the way back to the cell body. So the solid line is the preganglionic fiber, the dashed line is the postganglionic fiber. All right, so this illustration nicely shows divergence of signals, which then describes why when the sympathetic nervous system gets activated, that signal goes everywhere, right, which causes mass activation. All right, the next slide doesn't really show this principle of convergence very well, but it does sort of in a way. Okay, so here we have a preganglionic fiber, and here's another preganglionic fiber, and we can see them converging on the collateral ganglia, right, and stimulating just a single postganglionic cell. So when you have signals from multiple axons synapsing on a single postganglionic cell, that's what we mean by convergence. Right, and convergence and divergence of signals is just a hallmark of the sympathetic nervous system. Right, and when the sympathetic nervous system becomes activated, all organs in your body, right, receive that sympathetic activation. Right, so here is an illustration that shows nicely the sympathetic chain on either side of the vertebral column. Here and here, we call these what? The paravertebral ganglia, because they're on either side of the vertebral column. And then I see some other ganglia. These are the auxiliary ganglia to the sympathetic chain. They're anterior to the vertebral column, so we call these the prevertebral or the collateral, same terminology. All right, but remember, when sympathetic nerves leave the thoracolumbar spinal cord, right, they have to pass through at least one ganglia where there's going to be the postganglionic fiber. All right, so this is a pretty good picture, maybe a little bit better than even what's in your anatomy book. All right, here's the exception to that rule. And the rule was that it always takes two neurons to get to an effector organ, and it relates to the sympathoadrenal system. All right, where are the adrenal glands at? I don't know, do I have a picture of adrenal glands? Wow, I don't have a picture of adrenal glands. But you should know where they are. They're what, suprarenal glands? They're on top of the kidneys. And like most organs, it has a deep layer and a superficial layer. What do we call the superficial layer of the adrenal gland? The adrenal cortex, yeah, because the cortex is always the superficial layer on an organ. And what's the deep layer called? Yeah, the adrenal medulla. So these are, that's one organ, but vastly different depending on what region or what layer you're looking at. And we're going to be concerned in terms of the sympathetic system, the adrenal medulla exclusively. All right, so it's located in the adrenal gland, which is superior to the kidney, just right on top of the kidneys. And the adrenal medulla is really a modified collateral ganglia that has been incorporated with the rest of the adrenal gland. All right, so these cells, which are called chromaffin cells, when they receive action potentials from the preganglionic sympathetic neuron, they're stimulated to release epinephrine and norepinephrine. These are catecholamines, right? And these cells don't go across the synapse. These are actually picked up by the blood. And then once they get into the blood, where do they go? Everywhere in the body. So norepinephrine and epinephrine get secreted from the adrenal medulla when they're activated by the sympathetic nervous system. And then these compounds travel everywhere in the body and they bind to sympathetic receptors that are everywhere in the body. That's another example of what? Divergence of a signal, of a sympathetic signal, sympathetic activation, that happens everywhere where your circulatory system goes. So these cells are acting like a postganglionic cell, right? And these compounds, norepinephrine and epinephrine, since they're released into the blood, okay, they're acting like a hormone, because that's a definition of a hormone. It's released by a cell, and that the product that's released by a cell is picked up via the circulation and delivered through the circulation. That's a hormone. But these compounds are being released by a neuron. Okay, what do we call a compound that's released by a neuron? A neurotransmitter. Ah, so I feel a lot of confusion right at this point in time, because epinephrine and norepinephrine in this circumstance are kind of acting like a hormone, but they're released by a neuron, so they're acting like a neurotransmitter. What the heck are they? They are what we call a neurohormone, because this now shows a very nice interface between the nervous system and the endocrine system to maintain control over your body. And epinephrine and norepinephrine, when released from the adrenal gland, have a much longer action in the body compared to if norepinephrine was just released into a synapse. Right, so it's a longer duration of action, right? And it's going to have an effect everywhere in your body. So the adrenal gland, when it's stimulated, it mass activates your whole body as a result. Okay, let's just talk a little bit about some biochemistry before we look at a nice figure of these different systems. Epinephrine is made by methylating norepinephrine. So here is norepinephrine. I can just see that it's based on this tyrosine amino acid. And tyrosine, I think I mentioned before, is what kind of amino acid? What kind of an amino acid? It's an essential amino acid, right? So you can't make these signaling compounds, epinephrine and norepinephrine, without having tyrosine in your diet. And then it's converted into DOPA and then dopamine. Dopamine is another commonly used neurotransmitter in your body. Dopamine then is what happens. Well, it's oxidized at this location right here. So we have a hydroxyl group in this location. So dopamine and norepinephrine are related to each other. And then by methylation of this amino group right here, it becomes epinephrine. So these are small but significant changes in the structure of this particular compound, which means then it's going to have different activities in the body just because of these small changes. All right, but don't forget where you get these compounds from tyrosine, and they're related to each other. All right, before we talk some more about the sympathetic nervous system, I want to describe a little bit about the parasympathetic as well. All right, so sympathetic is what we call thoracolumbar because the preganglionics leave the spinal cord at the thoracic and lumbar division. But the parasympathetic outflow comes from cranial nerves, right, and sacral nerves, but not necessarily from spinal nerves, except these down here in the sacrum. So therefore, we call this division the cranial sacral division. And in particular, there's one cranial nerve that's very important that carries most of the traffic, and maybe you're aware of that from anatomy. But cranial nerve is really recognized as the most important parasympathetic nerve. It is a vagus nerve. And how many cranial nerves are there? Yeah, there's 12. And it just so happens that the vagus is number 10. Okay, so vagus is number 10. There's 12 altogether, and vagus is number 10. And we're going to see in just a second that that vagus nerve kind of wanders around everywhere in the body. It's kind of a wanderer, so it innervates many organs, at least in the superior part of your body, and hence that's what its name really means. It means a wanderer. What's another name for a wanderer? A vagabond. Yes, a vagabond. So that's how it got its name. Probably a very European kind of designation. Okay. Vagabond, vagrant. Okay. Vagrant. It just means that it's wandering around. Okay. And since it's an autonomic outflow pathway, how many neurons does it take to get from the central nervous system, whether it's the brain or spinal cord from the sacral division, to get to an effector organ? It's always going to require two. And there's going to be a ganglia someplace where there's a nice chemical synapse between the preganglionic and postganglionic neuron. Okay, and those ganglia are located within the target organ or right on the target organ, right on the connective tissue capsule of the target organ. And we call those terminal ganglia. So terminal ganglia are located in the parasympathetic nervous system. The paravertebral and prevertebral ganglia are part of the sympathetic nervous system in particular. All right, and since the terminal ganglia are located right next to or on top of or even sometimes inside the target organ, the postganglionic fibers are what? They're microscopic. They're very, very short because they don't have to travel very far. The postganglionic fibers in the sympathetic nervous system still might have to travel all the way from the vertebral column to the effector organ, so the postganglionic fibers for sympathetics are long, right? Postganglionics for parasympathetic nervous system have short axons as a result. The similarity, what's a similarity? Anybody remember between the parasympathetic and sympathetic postganglionic axons? One is short, one is long. But there is one similarity, and that has to do with the speed of conduction. In both cases, the axons for the postganglionics are not myelinated. They're unmyelinated. Preganglionics are always myelinated. Postganglionics are never myelinated. So the vagus nerve is the most important parasympathetic neuron. It innervates the heart, lung, esophagus, stomach, pancreas, a whole bunch of organs right in the upper half of the large intestine. And then preganglionics from S2 through 4 innervate the lower half of the large intestine, rectum, reproductive system, right? So many noteworthy organ systems. So here is a nice overview, kind of probably copied out of some anatomy book someplace. We see a bunch of effector organs way over here on the right, and they're nicely labeled, like here it says, eye, okay? Not too terribly difficult. You're familiar with all this stuff. All right, and I can see blue nervous system versus red. This is all autonomic outflow pathway. Blue represents the cranial sacral division, which is parasympathetic, right? And the red is thoracolumbar that represents sympathetic outflow, sympathetic nervous system. Okay, and then I see two kinds of neurons. I see neurons with a solid color, and then I see some with a dashed line. What does that mean? Yeah, preganglionic versus postganglionic. And what do you always have between the pre and postganglionic fiber? You have a ganglion, right? And since this is the parasympathetic nervous system, this would be a, what kind of ganglion would this be? A terminal ganglia, which are going to be very close to the eye, or maybe even right on the capsule of the eye. So the postganglionic fibers for parasympathetic are short. Here is a postganglionic fiber for the sympathetic nervous system, and what can you tell me about it compared to the parasympathetic? It's very long, but nonetheless it's similar in that it is non-myelinated, as signified by that dotted line right here. Okay, where do all of the sympathetic outflow preganglionic fibers have to pass to get to an effector organ? It has to pass through the sympathetic chain. Doesn't mean that it has to synapse there, but at least has to pass through it or synapse. All right, and if it synapses, then the postganglionic fiber leaves, okay, enters a spinal nerve and goes to an effector organ. Or sometimes the preganglionic fiber passes right through the sympathetic chain to a prevertebral or collateral ganglia where it synapses on the postganglionic cell. All right, now what kind of synapse do we have right here? As a matter of fact, how many general kinds of synapses are there in your body? Two, and hopefully I talked about them, but I can't remember. What are the two kinds? I'm sure I did. Chemical versus electrical, right? Electrical requires what kind of cell structure? A gap junction, okay? But these synapses right here are chemical synapses. There are no gap junctions. So how does this preganglionic fiber control the postganglionic fiber? How does that signal, how does that information get from the preganglionic to the postganglionic? If this is a chemical synapse, a neurotransmitter has to diffuse right across this synaptic cleft right here. And it's the same over here, right? And this is a chemical synapse. Here's a chemical synapse. All of these synapses are chemical synapses, which means then a neurotransmitter has to be released from the preganglionic, which then binds to a ligand-gated receptor in the postganglionic cell to either excite or inhibit the postganglionic cell. All right, the other thing, just for anatomy, which you should be aware of, when a nerve fiber passes straight through the sympathetic chain and goes to a prevertebral or collateral ganglia, what do we call that nerve? Because it's just not one fiber. It's going to be thousands of axons going someplace in the peripheral nervous system. So if we have myelinated axons going someplace in the peripheral nervous system, we call that that's a nerve. Okay, but what kind of nerve is it if it's carrying sympathetic information to a prevertebral or collateral ganglia? It's going to be a splanchnic nerve. It's always going to be a splanchnic nerve, right? So here's a splanchnic nerve. Here's one. Here's another splanchnic nerve right here, but it's not labeled exactly which one that is. That would probably be the, what I would guess, inferior mesenteric. Okay. So this is pretty good. How would you describe the action between these red pathways and blue pathways? Or the parasympathetic pathways compared to the sympathetic pathways? What's the relationship going to be in most cases? They're going to be antagonistic to each other. All right, and we're going to learn some maybe distinctions. There's one outflow pathway that is different. Okay, and let's take a look at the splanchnic nerve that goes to this celiac ganglia right here. I see sympathetic fibers passing straight through the sympathetic chain. They're going to synapse, right, in the celiac ganglia right here. You don't have to remember the name of this ganglion right here. All right, but I just see a nice chemical synapse between the preganglionic and postganglionic fibers, but I see an exception. I see one nerve fiber passing through the celiac ganglia just like it did through the sympathetic chain. And can you tell me where it's going? Do you see it yet? It's a little small maybe, but here is a preganglionic sympathetic fiber, did not synapse in the sympathetic chain, did not synapse in the celiac ganglia, and where does it go? Right to the adrenal medulla. So the preganglionic fiber goes all the way to the adrenal medulla, and there it synapses on a cell that we call a chromaffin cell, and that chromaffin cell is like the postganglionic fiber in other parts of the sympathetic nervous system, except when that cell becomes stimulated when it binds neurotransmitter from the preganglionic fiber. It doesn't institute an action potential. It just immediate, or doesn't transmit an action potential anywhere, right? It just immediately releases epinephrine and norepinephrine right inside the adrenal medulla, all right? But then that's not the end of the story. Where does that epinephrine and epinephrine go when the adrenal medulla secretes it? Yeah, because there are capillaries in the adrenal medulla which then absorb those compounds, and it travels through the cardiovascular system everywhere in the body. And those compounds can then bind to sympathetic receptors and all these other organs. Okay, so that's just another example of mass activation. So this is a nice exception to the rule of always having a preganglionic and postganglionic cell. But don't forget, those chromaffin cells are acting like the postganglionic cell. They're just not transmitting action potentials anywhere. They just immediately start to release those, what we call neurohormones, into the blood. Anything else I want to say on this slide? Probably not. Okay, who's got a question on this? The other thing you can see, maybe one last thing, here you can see cranial nerve number 10. What's the name of this one right here? Vagus nerve. You can see it kind of wandering around to what the vast majority of organs, effector organs in your body, hence its name. Okay, here's a table that kind of shows some important things. All right, for instance, we have some effector organs right here. This could be cardiac muscle, it could be glands, could be smooth muscle. All right, and then we have two columns for sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system. I probably won't read this whole table to you, but point out a couple important things. All right, for instance, sympathetic activity on the eye, the iris in particular, and the iris, what can dilate and constrict, it adjusts what? How much light enters the eye? Okay, so sympathetic causes dilation, parasympathetic causes constriction, all right, and does that make sense in terms of the general rule for the autonomic nervous system? What are the two general rules? Sympathetic is which one? Fight or flight response? Okay, and parasympathetic is rest and digest. So when you're driving down the freeway, and like when I was driving down Lincoln Boulevard just this morning, there was a big rapid transit bus on one side. There was another one that was making a left turn in the left-hand lane, and the one on the right was making a right-hand turn or stopping. So it kind of like scooted over into the lane I was in. Okay, but the one that was making a left-hand turn, what do people like to do before they make a left-hand turn sometimes? They kind of go to the right before they make the left-hand turn. So there I was between these two buses. One was going left, one was going right, and there I was right in the middle. I thought I was going to die, get squished by two RTA buses. And if I really thought that, what do you think would happen to my eyes, the pupil? Would they dilate so I could really see what's going on, or would they constrict so that I wouldn't see what was happening? Okay, they would dilate, right? Because that response, the fight or flight response, activated the sympathetic nervous system, and I'm sure my pupils dilated. So why? So that I could see better what was happening, right? So always relate these seemingly complicated effects to those two basic rules, and I think very quickly you'll see very early on that it's pretty easy to remember what the effects of sympathetic stimulation are compared to parasympathetic. Okay, what about the heart? What happened to my heart rate? It increased. So sympathetic was excitatory on my heart, at least in terms of the heart rate, right? Parasympathetic will decrease heart rate, right? So when you're resting and digesting, right, you don't need to have an accelerated heart rate because you're not dealing with any stressful circumstances. Also, under a stressful situation, right, maybe I would like to just jump out of my car and run away under circumstances like that, and my muscles will need a lot of blood flow, and what should that blood contain? Lots of oxygen, right? So should the bronchioles, which are the small air passageways in my lungs, should they dilate so that I get better oxygen perfusion of my lungs, or should they constrict? Okay, they should dilate. So again, that's a sympathetic nervous system. And when I want to jump out of my car and run away, let's see, what can I find right here? What about digestion? Where's the gastrointestinal tract? Okay. Should my body be really concerned about digesting a meal that I just had? Or should it take blood flow away from the digestive tract and give it to my brain and heart and eyes and muscles that will help me deal with the circumstance? Okay, so sympathetic activity is inhibitory on the gastrointestinal tract, right? And that's going to be, of course, the opposite effect on the parasympathetic. So always kind of relate activities of the sympathetic and parasympathetic to those two simple rules that we looked at. Is there another one that I want to look at? Maybe next time, but not right here. But it's interesting to look at that table right there. All right, let's look at some of the neurotransmitters of the autonomic nervous system. Why are we interested in neurotransmitters of the autonomic nervous system? Because what kind of synapses are there? Chemical synapses, right? So we're going to be interested in neurotransmitters. All right, so don't forget, how many neurons does it take to get from CNS to an effector organ? Always two, preganglionic, postganglionic. They're going to have a junction in a ganglia someplace, depending on whether it's sympathetic or parasympathetic. All right, here's one coming from the brainstem. Okay, actually looks like the medulla right here. So what kind of outflow is this going to be? Is this sympathetic or parasympathetic? Parasympathetic is cranial sacral, right? So here's some parasympathetic outflow pathway. And the neurotransmitter that's used in this terminal ganglia for all ganglia in the parasympathetic nervous system is going to be ACH, which is acetylcholine. Yeah, that's probably your favorite neurotransmitter because you use it for skeletal muscles at the neuromuscular junction. Ah, we haven't talked about that yet. Okay. We'll get to muscles soon. All right, so the preganglionic fiber releases acetylcholine, so the postganglionic fiber has to have acetylcholine ligand-gated channels. Right, and since the preganglionic fiber is releasing acetylcholine, how do we talk about that neuron right there? We can characterize it as to being what? A cholinergic neuron. Right, so here's a cholinergic neuron. And what about the postganglionic fiber for this parasympathetic outflow pathway? What's the neurotransmitter that's being used? Same one, acetylcholine. So the postganglionic fiber is also cholinergic. The pre- and postganglionic fibers for most parasympathetic outflow pathways are cholinergic neurons because they use acetylcholine. All right, so sympathetic, we should expect some differences, right? Because it has vastly different effects in your body, usually antagonistic. So here's a nice red preganglionic fiber. Which one is that? What are your choices? Parasympathetic or sympathetic? Which one is that? It's thoracolumbar, so it's got to be sympathetic. Here's the neurotransmitter that's being released. Ah, I'm shocked. It's the same one, acetylcholine. All right, well, let's check another sympathetic outflow pathway. Let's look at this middle one right here. What's a neurotransmitter that's being released on the chromaffin cells of the adrenal medulla to stimulate them? Ah, look, it's acetylcholine once again. Let's check another one. Here's our third one. Oh, look at that. Here's the preganglionic, here's the postganglionic fiber. What's the neurotransmitter in this ganglia? Acetylcholine. And then, well, it's not so surprising that we have acetylcholine used for the sacral outflow for parasympathetic, but it's acetylcholine once again. Wow, what can you tell me about all of these preganglionic fibers? Irrespective as to whether or not they're parasympathetic or sympathetic. What kind of nerve fibers are they? By the kind of neurotransmitter that they release. They're all cholinergic neurons, okay, because they release acetylcholine. All right, now how is it that they can have opposite effects on these different organs? The neurotransmitter is the same, but the receptors are going to be different, okay? So we're going to look at some receptors in just a little bit. Okay. All right, let's look at the postganglionic fibers. So here is a parasympathetic pathway. The postganglionic fiber releases acetylcholine. All right, and then this sympathetic outflow pathway, the postganglionic neuron, is releasing norepinephrine. So there's a switch right here. For the sympathetic nervous system, in every case, the preganglionic is cholinergic. But what can you tell me about the postganglionic fiber because it's releasing norepinephrine? It is adrenergic. So these are adrenergic fibers. So parasympathetic will almost always be cholinergic, and the sympathetic will almost always be adrenergic. Okay, and here's that nice exception. We don't see postganglionic fibers because epinephrine and norepinephrine in this particular case, what would we want to call these compounds? Neurotransmitters? And the best thing you might want to just jot in right here, your book is just a little bit behind the times, we would call that a neurohormone in particular, right? And hormone is not too far, okay, not too far afield, but there's a better way of thinking about it. Okay. All right, autonomic nervous system neurotransmitters. And the usual kind of synaptic vesicle for a motor neuron is going to be contained in the axon terminus, in the Bouton terminale. All right, but if it's an autonomic motor neuron, like I see right here, there are swellings along the axon that we call varicosities, which contain synaptic vesicles. So synaptic vesicles are not just contained at the axon terminus, but they're arranged along the whole length of the axon as it passes through an effector organ. And if this is smooth muscle, it could have dual innervation. It could have sympathetic and parasympathetic neurons that are releasing different neurotransmitters onto the smooth muscle. All right, and since we're talking about both of these, well, they're both sympathetic, so both divisions of the autonomic nervous system, these cells right here are postganglionic fibers. They're not preganglionic fibers, so that means that they're not secreting the same neurotransmitter. Sympathetic is releasing norepinephrine, remember the previous slide, and the parasympathetic is releasing acetylcholine. All right, and then it's the job of the smooth muscle right here to figure out on its own whether or not it should contract based on how much norepinephrine it receives and how much acetylcholine it receives, which is a big difference compared to skeletal muscle. This smooth muscle can decide whether or not it's going to contract or adjust its rate of contraction, but what about skeletal muscle? Skeletal muscle only has a somatic motor neuron going to it. It releases only acetylcholine, right? So a skeletal muscle can never make up its own mind whether it's going to contract, right? It will always contract, which is a good thing, because if I'm desperate for your little glass of water right there and I tell my skeletal muscles to go and grab it, what are they going to do? They will always obey, right? They can't ever make up their own mind and say no, okay? Okay, that's not true for cardiac and for smooth muscle. So these synapses right here, since they occur along the whole length of the axon, we call these synapses en passant, so in passing. And then it's the job of the smooth muscle to integrate the effects of sympathetic stimulation and parasympathetic stimulation to adjust its physiology, its rate of contraction. All right, and what kind of receptors does it look like? Whether they're adrenergic receptors or cholinergic receptors on smooth muscle. What does this guy look like? It looks like a G protein coupled receptor. They're not just ion channels that open up. These are G protein coupled receptors that bind acetylcholine, okay, or norepinephrine, which will then cause the development of second messengers inside the cell, which are going to regulate the activity of the smooth muscle cell. All right, so let's look at adrenergic stimulation, which is going to be due to norepinephrine as a neurotransmitter. Adrenergic receptors sometimes can be excitatory or can be inhibitory, depending on the particular tissue. All right, and so we're going to call these alpha and beta. So there are two major kinds of adrenergic receptors. But nonetheless, if it's an adrenergic receptor, whether it's an alpha or a beta, what is going to be the ligand that binds to this receptor? If we say adrenergic, it's going to be norepinephrine, right, released from the postganglionic sympathetic fibers. And furthermore, these receptors right here even have some subtypes, like there's alpha 1, alpha 2, beta 1, beta 2, and that's the depth that we'll get into in this class. As a matter of fact, we won't even consider the alpha 2s right here necessarily, but just kind of in passing. Okay, all of these receptors right here are G protein coupled receptors. None are ligand gated channels, but they work through second messengers, after a G protein becomes activated. The beta receptors all use cyclic AMP as a second messenger. So where are you always going to find cyclic AMP if it's a second messenger? Inside the cell, right? And where's norepinephrine always going to be found? Outside the cell, because that's the first messenger. And norepinephrine is a hydrophilic compound, can't get through the cell membrane. All right? While the other class of receptors, the alpha receptors, use calcium as a second messenger. And where would we find calcium if alpha adrenergic receptor becomes stimulated? Okay, it's high outside the cell, but when that receptor becomes activated, it rushes inside the cell or somehow is released inside the cell, and so calcium is the second messenger inside the cell. All right, so let's take a look at some of these effects right here. In the eye, at least in terms of adrenergic stimulation or sympathetic stimulation, right, causes contraction of the radial fibers of the iris. All right, when the radial fibers contract, they're all pointing to the pupil. When they contract, it dilates the pupil when that happens. All right, so alpha-1 receptors are excitatory on the smooth muscles of the iris. So you just might want to put excitatory. All right, the heart has primarily beta-1 receptors. Beta-1 receptors increase heart rate and increase force of contraction. I think I want to write something down on the board. These are two different effects on the heart. One increases rate, the other increases the force of contraction. So this morning when I was going to be squished by those two buses, what happened to my heart? And could I feel what was happening? The rate was increasing. I could feel my heart racing, but that's not the only thing. What else? If you ever got into a situation like that, you'd feel your heart like jumping outside of your chest, right? If you thought you were going to die for sure, your heart would start pounding inside your chest, okay? And you probably could see your thorax wall beating out. So the force of contraction would increase, but what else? The rate as well. So those are two different effects on the heart. Let's see what we got right here. The first one has to do with rate. Okay, the second one has to do with force of contraction. The rate is what we call chronotropy, because chrono refers to time, right, or rate, and force refers to inotropy of the heart. Okay, so the sympathetic nervous system is both a positive chronotropic agent and a positive inotropic agent, which means it increases both. And that's due to the beta-1 receptors. All right, let's look at some smooth muscles in arterioles. All right, norepinephrine is going to cause constriction of these arterioles because it has alpha-1 receptors. And we're going to see what that does when we get into the cardiovascular system. So does sympathetic activity inhibit or excite, okay, these smooth muscles in arterioles? Okay, it excites, right? So these alpha-1 receptors are excitatory. What about alpha-1 receptors in the eye? Excitatory or inhibitory? Excitatory. So do you see a common theme developing for these alpha-1 receptors? Are they excitatory or inhibitory? They're excitatory. So typically alpha-1 receptors are excitatory. And the alpha-2s, we're not going to really talk about, but they're in the brain and they can have various effects on the sympathetic nervous system, which we can't really talk about in this class. Okay, the other receptor that I want to talk about here is the beta-2. Here I see a beta-2, and here's another beta-2, right? Dilates arterioles and dilates bronchioles in airways, right, leading to the lungs, right? And when those smooth muscles relax, that causes dilation of the diameter of those tubes. So beta-2 would be what, excitatory or inhibitory? They would be inhibitory, right? But they're still adrenergic neurons, right, that are exciting these tissues. So beta-1 is excitatory, beta-2 is inhibitory. And we're going to see how that action plays out. All right, so how can you remember that? Okay, sympathetic is what, the fight or flight response? When it goes to the heart, it's going to stimulate the heart. I think you should have a pretty good intuitive sense of that. And what kind of receptors do you have in the heart? How many hearts do you have? You have one heart. And you should just kind of intuitively know it's excitatory. All right, beta 2 receptors, beta 2 adrenergic receptors. Right, go to airways that inhibit the airways, which means then they start to dilate. What kind of receptors are in the airways of your lungs? How many lungs do you have? You've got 2. And it has what? The beta 2 receptors. All right, so that should be pretty easy to remember. The other thing about these alpha 1s right here, they're pretty much always going to be excitatory. They're going to cause smooth muscle contraction. So this table might seem pretty complicated, but it's not too bad if you think about it in those terms. All right, here is a really good exam figure. And when we look at these neuronal pathways right here, are they going to be autonomic pathways or somatic pathways? When you just give it a cursory look without too much analysis, somatic or autonomic? Okay, and a somatic would be what? Just skeletal muscle? How many neurons does it take? Takes 1. How many neurons do you see right here? Every case you see 2 neurons, so it has to be an autonomic outflow pathway. All right, so here's going to be a ganglia that has these cell bodies someplace, and you should know if it's parasympathetic, what we call those ganglia. If it's sympathetic, what you call those ganglia? Well, let's say it. For parasympathetic, what kind of ganglia is it? It's called a terminal ganglia, very close to the effector organ. Okay, and what are the ganglia for the sympathetics? Let's just talk about the 2 usual kind. With the paravertebral on either side in the sympathetic chain, or the prevertebral, sometimes we call that collateral, right, in front of the vertebral column. And then the last example would be the one that goes to the adrenal medulla. There's not really a ganglion there. It's those chromaffin cells that are sort of acting like the ganglion. All right, what's the neurotransmitter that's used at all ganglia? It's going to be acetylcholine. So each of these dots right here represents acetylcholine. Okay, and the receptors in each of the postganglionic fibers is going to be a nicotinic acetylcholine receptor, all right, which is what? Just a ligand-gated channel. So that when acetylcholine binds to it, what happens to that channel? It opens up. And when that channel opens up, what is the primary action that occurs? Mostly sodium enters the cell. As a result, some potassium does leave, but primarily it's sodium that enters the cell. And you should have a sense as to why that is, because sodium is high. Why? Outside the cell, not inside. So sodium rushes in. But more importantly, what happens to the membrane potential when sodium rushes in? It depolarizes. And what kind of signal is that? Is that excitatory or inhibitory? That's excitatory because it depolarizes the cell, right? Which then produces EPSPs, which then, if they reach the axon terminus right here, that produces an action potential on the postganglionic cell. All right, so acetylcholine at the ganglia is always going to be excitatory because it's the same receptor, okay, which is a nicotinic acetylcholine receptor. All right, if it's a parasympathetic, the postganglionic fiber is cholinergic, which means that it releases acetylcholine, all right, and it can be excitatory or inhibitory depending on what kind of receptors are in the effector organ. And now we will learn of another class of acetylcholine receptors, and these are what we call muscarinic receptors. These are just G protein coupled receptors. They're not ligand gated channels. All right, and it can produce various effects. It can be inhibitory or excitatory on various organs depending on how the G protein is coupled to other membrane proteins. So for instance, if acetylcholine binds to that G protein, which then opens up a potassium channel, what's going to happen to the effector organ if a potassium channel opens up? It's going to hyperpolarize. It's going to move farther away from the threshold, so it becomes inhibited, right? But if it's a muscarinic channel that opens up a sodium channel, what happens to membrane potential? Moves closer to threshold, so it can be excitatory. All right, so muscarinic channels are always G-protein coupled, but they can be inhibitory or excitatory just depending on the particular tissue. All right, let's look at these three examples of sympathetic outflow pathways. Maybe norepinephrine is being released on a tissue that has alpha-1 adrenergic receptors. What's an alpha-1 receptor typically, did we say? Excitatory or inhibitory? Excitatory. So it's going to cause vasoconstriction, right? It's going to cause arterioles to constrict. Beta-1 receptors. Where do we have beta-1 receptors? Your heart, okay? And beta-1 is always excitatory. It's going to increase both the chronotropy and inotropy of the heart, both force of contraction and heart rate, okay? And beta-2 receptors. Where do you have beta-2 receptors? Your lungs. Yeah, your lungs. Okay, and so they're contained on smooth muscle of bronchioles. And when norepinephrine binds to beta-2 receptors, does that cause inhibition or excitation of smooth muscle of bronchioles? Inhibition, so that they will dilate. It will be easier to ventilate, bring air in and out of your lungs. Okay, drugs that promote the actions of a neurotransmitter are what we call agonists, right? Because sometimes we would like to help pharmacologically manage different parts of a patient's body by giving drugs to them. So if there's something that acts like a normal neurotransmitter, we call that an agonist. If it inhibits the action of a neurotransmitter, we would call that an antagonist. All right, so here is something. Okay, nicotinic receptors are stimulated by nicotine. Where is nicotine commonly found? Yeah, cigarettes. Used to be a very popular drug. Okay, but you can see that it can have some amazing and astounding activation of the autonomic nervous system. Now, why is it when somebody takes a lot of nicotine into their body, it just does not automatically kill them? Because you can see all of these autonomic neurons have receptors. And now you're having a big overdose of nicotine. How is it that somebody can even live through a challenge like that? Because what happens when you have nicotine? Does it stimulate the parasympathetic nervous system or inhibit? Nicotine is an agonist, so it stimulates the parasympathetic nervous system. Okay, and what's the effect on the sympathetic nervous system? It is excitatory as well. All right, so it excites the postganglionic fibers in the parasympathetic nervous system and sympathetic nervous system. Okay, now here's really the interesting thing that happens. What happens if you excite both the parasympathetic and sympathetic at the same time? One nervous system is going to be excitatory, the other is inhibitory, and when these things add together on an organ, what's the overall effect? Nothing. That's what we mean by balance, right? So if there is an improper signal that's stimulating both the parasympathetic and sympathetic at the same time, they cancel out. That's really the beauty of having an antagonistic control over a subsystem, like on your car. If you hit the gas pedal and the brake at the same time, what happens? You continue at the same speed. Okay, so that's what we mean about a balanced input. So you can take some nicotine, right? It won't automatically kill you. But, for instance, if someone takes muscarin, which is a compound from certain kinds of mushrooms, all right, do you still have that balance control? What system only has muscarinic receptors? Only the parasympathetic nervous system. There's nothing to balance it out on the sympathetic side, right? And that usually is fatal very rapidly when that happens. Okay. So that's the beauty of sympathetic and parasympathetic being antagonistic to each other. So acetylcholine is used at all motor neurons. Okay, except in skeletal muscle, all preganglionics and parasympathetic postganglionic fibers are cholinergic. Right? Cholinergic receptors have two subtypes. There's a nicotinic kind, which is just a ligand-gated channel. A sodium channel is going to open up when acetylcholine binds to it. It's stimulated by nicotine, but it's blocked by another compound called curare. And there were some people that discovered that curare could be used very effectively as a hunting aid because they could inject some curare into a big game animal that they would use for food, and that curare then would block cholinergic receptors in skeletal muscle, which means what would happen to the animal? It couldn't run away. But there's another important skeletal muscle too that you need every minute of your life, and that is your, you don't need your biceps every minute of your life or your quadriceps, but there is one that you need every minute, and that is your diaphragm, okay? Your diaphragm, which causes inspiration. So when you poison that muscle, guess what happens? Can't breathe. I don't know. We probably, none of us could run very far when we can't breathe, okay? So curare was a really nice agent that certain Aboriginal peoples could coat on their little darts and hunting arrows, inject into a big animal, and then they could just walk up to that big animal and have a party. That was pretty handy use of receptors, okay, to do that. Muscarinic, on the other hand, stimulated by a compound from mushrooms called muscarin, all right, and of course those mushrooms are very poisonous, and it can be blocked by atropine. So atropine can be used as an antidote to this kind of poisoning, okay, because it can block that effect. All right, so let's take a look at some of these different receptors. We've got nicotinic on the left and muscarinic on the right. And we said that a nicotinic receptor, right, we find them in all autonomic ganglia, right, between the pre- and post-ganglionic neurons. At all neuromuscular junctions, and even in some pathways inside the central nervous system. And you saw this scheme before when acetylcholine binds to two sites, two active sites on this particular protein. It changes the conformation of this channel, opens it up, and the primary effect is sodium entering the cell, which is depolarization, which is excitation. All right, so that's pretty easy to see. So this is just a nice ligand-gated ion channel. All right, muscarin receptors are all G-protein-coupled receptors. All right, so let's look at the first case. If acetylcholine binds to the receptor, it's going to activate the G-protein, and then a subunit of the G-protein will wander around through the membrane. It can bump into a potassium channel that is normally closed, and it will cause a conformation change to where it's open, so potassium can leave the cell. What's going to happen to the electrical properties of the cell when potassium leaves? Does the inside become more negative or more positive? More negative, because potassium is a cation, and we call that hyperpolarization that drives the cell farther away from threshold, and we call that inhibition, right? And it could slow the heart rate, for instance, and slow the rate of contraction when that happens, okay, on the heart. Here is another kind of receptor. Right, it's an acetylcholine receptor, but it's a G protein. But in this particular case, the dissociated subunits of the G protein will bump into a channel, okay, that's normally open and cause it to close. And if it's a potassium channel, right, if potassium is normally leaving the cell without excitation, it's going to cause hyperpolarization. But when it changes conformation, it's going to close. What's going to happen? If this channel usually causes hyperpolarization and it's forced to close, it's going to cause the opposite, which is depolarization, which is excitatory. All right, and so this is what happens in the digestive tract. When acetylcholine binds to this receptor, it excites the digestive tract, okay, because of this potassium channel. All right, and so these things work through second messengers, which we might look at in a little bit. And this, I'm going to say some other things about this table, but it's important for you to know your adrenergic receptors, your alpha and beta, alpha 1, beta 1, and beta 2. Unless there is a question, and I think maybe I have one question, online question, that talks about different muscarinic receptors, right? I'm not going to test you on the different kinds of muscarinic receptors, like M3, M5, M2 kinds of receptors. But you should at least be aware that there are different kinds of muscarinic receptors, right, that which can produce different effects inside the body, even though it's the same neurotransmitter, right? So the same neurotransmitter can have different actions in the body because different parts of the body might have different kinds of receptors producing different responses. Oh, last slide. Okay, I guess I don't have to say much more about that next time. We're going to start with sensory next time, unless I can remember some things that I forgot. And the sign-in sheet is going around someplace. So those of you that have friends taking anatomy, tell them to really learn their nervous system, their autonomic nervous system, so they don't have to go back and learn it. Hi. Oh, wow. You want to check your test right now? Do you have lab right now?
No, but I know what I got. It's just where it did, you haven't put the exam once for. So I don't know. Yeah.
Oh, you know, I saw that note to myself when I was at home, but I had your exam one here at school.
Okay.
So, can you go up to my office with me right now? Let's do it. Because otherwise I'll have you write your name down in your section, but we can just take care of that right now.
I have to do time.
Good.